can walk as fast as I want, so I walk about 6 miles an hour. Most people think I'm jogging, but I'm really just walking. So, but anyway, trying to stay in shape. So, several of you have been asking me questions throughout this week and about the arsenic life that they found. It's really not arsenic life, it's carbon-based life, but I'm not going to take class time because we have about a 45-minute podcast that's up on our website. The podcasts are free. And Fuzz, our staff biochemist, and myself kind of went through what was discovered and how it plays in to a biblical creation model. I've also written an article on it, and the article will be published sometime in January. So that'd be a good place to go. But if you've got questions, feel free to ask me afterwards. Some of you are also asking me questions about the bacteria that are consuming the Titanic, and we also did a podcast on that. So you can pick that one. And it's a bacterial strain that has been slowly evolving over the past 80 years, but is now such that it's in a state where it can very efficiently consume the metals that make up the Titanic. And they say within 15 years, the Titanic will be completely consumed by the bacteria. Pretty amazing. So, but, you know, we kind of did a podcast making the point that bacteria were purposely designed to go undergo this microevolution so that they can take care of different problems like that, including radioactive waste. Another good example is the British Petroleum oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. A bacterial strain has basically erased that entire spill. So, you know, thank God for bacteria that eat up all of our garbage. So, if you want to see the Titanic, you better take advantage of it because within, they say, 15 years, all you'll have is a rust stain at the bottom of the ocean. So, and likewise, British Petroleum, we thought they were going to spend billions cleaning up that spill. The bacteria took care of it for them. You get your hand up first, so go ahead.
Yes,
oh, no, sorry. This is a gentleman right here, then we'll get to you. Okay, go ahead. There will be a rust stain at the bottom of the ocean, but that's it. The superstructure, everything will be gone. And what's amazing is for 80 years, it was intact. Nothing, but what is happening is bacteria in that vicinity. See, it's very deep water, so there isn't a lot of bacterial activity there, but bacteria very slowly underwent microevolution and got to a point where it was able to efficiently use the iron as an energy source. But now that that microevolution is complete, a huge population of bacteria have multiplied incredibly. In fact, you can go on the web and you can see a photograph of one of the smokestacks that they pulled up from the bottom. As they pulled it out of the water, they saw coming down from the smokestack what they called rusticles, which are basically huge structures of iron bacterial mush. And so what they were actually seeing was that the one of the funnels was being quickly consumed by the bacteria. So you can see the funnel, and then about 40 feet high, but underneath is about 30 feet of these rusticles, which are basically just these kind of stalagmites of bacteria that are consuming the iron. So, but and you had a question.
I'm not a question. I got to meet a survivor of the Titanic 25 years ago. She lived up in Santa Barbara, and I took a book up there that was written about it at the time in 1912, and she autographed it. She said, "I was 12 then, I'm now 85, and I'm very glad to be alive." And then 6 months later, I took my tape recorder and interviewed her and got it on tape, and a friend in the photograph club made CDs for me.
Oh, neat.
If you ever want to hear something like that, I can bring it in.
Right. Very good. Right. Right. That's kind of neat.
And she passed away 20 years ago.
All right. Yeah, John.
I don't know if you heard that this arsenic report is now being widely discredited that they may have failed to properly detect the samples from contamination. So it may or may not be.
Well, it's a little more complicated, John. There were several people that complained that they didn't do the experiment properly, and then there was a counter response where they said, we really did, and they actually weighed the DNA and found that there was arsenic there. What's still in doubt is whether the arsenate is actually part of the DNA superstructure or just simply incorporated in some unknown way. But having read all the responses and counter-responses, it seems to both Fuzz and me that this bacterial strain really was taking in an extra load of arsenate than it had before. Keep in mind, however, it's a bacteria that they purposely pulled from an area that's very arsenic-rich and relatively phosphorus-poor. And so we referred to it in our podcast not as an arsenic-based life form, but rather as an arsenic-tolerant life form. And so it's able to tolerate arsenic, but it doesn't prefer arsenic. In fact, the only way they got the arsenic into the bacteria was by taking it out of the Mono Lake sediment and then putting it in a lab, removing phosphorus, and then loading it up with tons of arsenate. Not tons, but you know what I mean. Several grams worth. And so the environment was saturated with arsenate, and they purposely took all the phosphate out. So basically, the bacteria had no choice but to substitute phosphate for the arsenate. Even then, they did not get all the phosphorus out. I mean, it's still predominantly a phosphorus-based life form, but they did measure that there was some arsenate tolerance there. And for what it's worth, every one of us has arsenic in our bodies, and it's not something we're tolerating, it's actually something we're using. For human beings, arsenic is a vital metal that you need in your bodies. But you only need 1/10 millionth of your body to be arsenic. Yeah, if it's more than 1/10 millionth, you're in trouble. But you do need 1/10 millionth. Having zero in your body would be deadly. We call it a vital poison in the sense that if you don't have enough of it, it will kill you. If you have too much of it, it will also kill you. And in the case of arsenic, it must be extremely fine-tuned for human life. And it turns out this is also true even for bacterial species. It must be fine-tuned. Almost every life form uses arsenic as a vital function. But the problem is arsenic is so close chemically to phosphorus that life is always in danger of the arsenic replacing the phosphorus. And because it chemically behaves the same way, that's quite easy to do, which is why arsenic is such a deadly poison. Put enough of it in your food, and your body will begin to replace the phosphorus with that, and it will kill you. It kills you. Because unlike phosphorus, the arsenate compounds are unstable. But this bacterial species, because of its living in Mono Lake sediment, already had within it biochemical machinery to do DNA repair. And so bacteria that live in these extreme habitats basically use up a huge amount of the energy within the organism to do repair work. And so because we're living under benign conditions, we don't have to work so hard at repairing our DNA. But this is one. And because it's a bacterium, it only lives for, you know, a few minutes or a few hours anyway. And so the phosphate or the arsenate is unstable in this time span of a few hours. That won't be deadly, but for a human being, it would be deadly. I mean, we're programmed to live longer than a few hours, but a bacteria is not. So it can tolerate instability a lot better. So that's a quick summary of our 45-minute. And actually, what I did, just I'll add one more thing. This would never happen in the real world, because in the real world, phosphorus is always far more abundant than arsenic. In the Earth's crust, it's 667 times more abundant than the arsenic. In the rest of the universe, it's 2,500 times more abundant. And so given that there's much more phosphorus, given that it's more stable, life will always prefer the phosphorus to the arsenic. And so we're not going to be able to find an environment. In fact, what they did is they went to the one place on the planet where you got the greatest ratio of arsenic to phosphorus. But even in the Mono Lake sediment, there's more phosphorus than there is arsenic. Okay, a couple of questions. I don't want to get on to what I really want to talk about. Yes, go ahead.
Where was this found, this arsenic?
They took a bacterial species out of the sediment in Mono Lake.
Where's Mono Lake?
Mono Lake is in central California, in the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada, and it's a very salty lake. It's got three times the salt content of ocean water, And unlike other salt lakes, it's particularly enriched with arsenic. So, yeah, I mean, it'd be the ideal place to go to try to find one of these extremophilic bacteria. But it's not a natural existing one. In other words, they didn't just take the thing out of the sediment and say, look, it's using arsenate. They had to take it into a lab, removed access to the phosphorus, and load it up with arsenate before they could get the result they were looking for. So it's not a naturally occurring phenomena that they found. And that's the thing that a lot of the blog sites overlooked. They were announcing, you know, NASA's discovered arsenic-based life. Well, there's two problems with that. Number one, it's still a carbon-based life form. So it's using carbon as a base for assimilating the arsenic, and it's simply replacing some of the phosphorus with arsenic, not all of the phosphorus with arsenic. So in that sense, the blog claims are overblown, but if you actually read the article that was published in Science, it was quite subdued in its claims. But yeah, there were a lot of counter things where people were saying, we're not sure you did this experiment right. But what I did appreciate about the researchers, they said in their paper, this needs to be confirmed. They said, this is what we have discovered, but before you take our claim seriously, this needs to be confirmed. And so they were calling for a confirmation. That's not yet happened, but having read the paper, they did seem to exercise considerable care in showing that indeed this particular bacterial species had more arsenate than it would have if it was just simply sitting in Mono Lake. But exactly where the arsenic is, we don't know, and certainly it wasn't a complete replacement. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, scientifically speaking, which is more important, the Mono Lake bacteria or the Craig Venter's synthetic bacteria that he made?
No, this is very similar, Al. In both cases, it's a laboratory result, not a naturally occurring result. So, yeah, you can use the analogy of Craig Venter's lab, where they take existing life and re-engineer it. In one sense, at a much less sophisticated level, that's what this group is doing.
But do you doubt that in the next few years, they're going to take some chemicals, since we're all chemicals, going to take some chemicals right off the some bottles in the shelf and create life? I have no doubt about that whatsoever.
Well, I don't doubt that they'll be able to take existing life forms, break it down into component parts, and put it back together in a different fashion. You know, similar to, say, a teenager taking your automobile, taking it all apart, and putting it back together and souping it up. I think that's certainly within the means of presently existing human technology. No one, including Venter himself, is saying we can do this from scratch, where you basically take a bucket of dirt from the Mojave Desert and make a living life form out of it. They're not claiming that they're anywhere close to doing that. And the reason why there is a great deal of skepticism that it'll ever be done is that there's been experiments over the past 30 years of simply trying to put together the amino acids to make proteins. And where the most research has been done is putting together nucleotides to try to make DNA and RNA. And what they're discovering is that the greatest success is where they use a mineral substrate to put together the nucleotides. But what they're discovering is the longer the chain that they construct, the more difficult it is to construct. Moreover, the greater the gluing effect between the mineral substrate and the DNA strand that they're making. And so the greatest success has been achieved, I think, is about 49 or 50 nucleotides that they put together in a mineral substrate. But when they get up that high, they can't pull it off. And if you can't pull it off the substrate, it's useless for any life function. And so there seems to be an intractable construction problem when it comes to DNA. And any other medium you use besides the substrate, the best they can get is up to about 10 or 12. Nucleotides together before it falls apart. With the mineral substrate, they can prevent it from falling apart, but they can't pull it off.
But if life started in this world, it has to all the elements of chemical that are still here.
So I'm sure.
It came from outer space on a comet or something like that where it's seeded. But I think if life started on this planet, all the components, chemicals, are still here.
Well, the components are still here, Al, but origin of life researchers have really come to the point where they say it can't happen on the Earth. And that's because of these laboratory attempts at trying to put these things together. The other problem that is truly intractable is how do you get by naturalistic means all the nucleotides being joined with right-handed sugars? Because everything we see is you get a mixture of left and right-handed sugars. And if that happens, there's no way you can construct the backbone to put the nucleotides together. And you run into a similar problem with amino acids, is that we see no pathway whereby these amino acids would all come in as a left-handed configuration. And therefore, there have been people saying it must have happened in outer space because it can't happen on the Earth. But as an astronomer, I can tell you, as tough it is to make it happen on the Earth, it's even more challenging to make it happen in outer space. And the reason for the excitement about outer space is that laboratory experiments have shown that if you have circularly polarized ultraviolet light, that will preferentially destroy one-handedness against the other. So if you've got a mixture of left and right-handed sugars, you can use circularly polarized ultraviolet light to destroy either the left-handed sugars or the right-handed sugars and thereby get a mixture that would be all left or right. Well, that's the hope. The best they've ever been able to do in laboratory experiments is get a 38% preference, which means that you'd have 138 right-handed ones for every 100 left-handed ones. And in order to get up to that 38%, you have to basically destroy virtually the whole sample of the sugars or the amino acids in the case of trying to get that 38%. But to make it work for assembly, it must be 100%. And then the other problem is it only works if the circularly polarized ultraviolet light is coming out at just one wavelength only. There's something in spectroscopy called the Condon-Kuhn rule. The Condon-Kuhn rule is that if one wavelength preferentially destroys a particular handedness, the next adjacent wavelength will destroy the opposite, which means that if you have any kind of a broadband ultraviolet radiation coming through, it's going to be 50-50. Because, you know, one wavelength will destroy the left, the next adjacent wavelength will destroy the right, and therefore you're not going to win. And nowhere in astronomy, anywhere in the universe, do we see circularly polarized ultraviolet light coming out at only one wavelength. In fact, the only place we see circularly polarized ultraviolet light is in the immediate vicinity of black holes and neutron stars, which has got to be the worst place in the universe to have amino acids or sugars or the nucleotides. The radiation there will literally break things down to the individual atoms, which is why the last Origin of Life research conference that Fuzz, Ron, and I attended, as we walked into the first lecture of the four-day conference, there was just this pall of despair and despondency, where they said, you know, we're getting absolutely nowhere. It's worse now than it was 3 years ago, and 3 years ago was worse, as at every meeting the situation is getting worse. We didn't think it was getting worse, but we were the only Christians that were there. The rest of them were atheists. And so from their perspective, it was getting worse and worse and worse. Well, yeah, it's easy for God. That's the whole point. And what Craig Venter is demonstrating, as easy it is for God, it's still extremely challenging for human beings to try to pull us off, even with all our technology and financing. So, well, we are created in the image of God, which means we're created to design and create things like God does. But we can't do it as well as God. And so, you know, Fuzz, if he were here, he would say, you know, I don't dispute the fact that 1,000 years from now, we might be able to figure out with our advanced technology that we don't yet have, how to put these molecules together. But all that will do is show what a very intelligent and knowledgeable and very powerful creator is necessary to make it happen in the first place. I mean, you know, we're smart and intelligent. It's got to be somebody that's smarter and more intelligent and better funded than we are that made it all happen. You know, wind blowing through the dirt isn't going to do it. Yes.
But even if they put some something together, isn't self-replication another matter that's just orders and orders of magnitude more farther out? I mean, they would need RNA and DNA, and which is just mind-boggling, and they would need all the assembly machines.
Well, if you want to read about this, Fuzz has got two books. One is over there on the table called The Cell's Design. But he's got a brand new one coming out called Life in the Lab, where he talks about Venter and other researchers who've been attempting to take bacterial life forms, break them down into components, and see if they can re-engineer them. And incidentally, we're very much in favor of this research. We think it's got exciting potential for engineering bacteria to do things that can really help us. They're looking at it in terms of medical advances. Craig Venter was saying, we can re-engineer bacteria to clean up oil spills. Well, we now found out bacteria can do it without Craig Venter's help. So, well, yeah, he's working on algae as an energy source because, maybe algae can produce fats at a very efficient rate that we can use to substitute for petroleum. So there's lots of great advances that are in store for doing this kind of thing. But what you'll see in Craig's work, or pardon me, Fuzz Rana's work, is that everybody's been focusing on what's called the RNA problem, how to put together the nucleotides and the sugars so that you can get RNA, on the belief that if you get RNA, that RNA can evolve into proteins and DNA. And so they're looking at it as the simplest problem. But, I can tell you, having attended one of these Origin of Life research conferences, the prime proponent of the RNA world hypothesis, Leslie Orgel, gave the opening lecture at the last conference we attended, and his comment at the very beginning of the lecture was this: I hope there are no creationists in the audience for what I'm going to say next. It would take a miracle for RNA to come together on planet Earth. So Puzz and I quickly wrote down the quote verbatim, and you'll see it in the Origins of Life book over there. So, and what's interesting, they knew exactly who we were. We weren't at all hiding ourselves. So, and by the way, we were well welcomed. They looked at us as being serious scientists and researchers. So, they basically said we can come back anytime. So. But what Fuzz points out is the RNA problem is only one problem. You also have to find a way to put the proteins together. You have to find a way for the alphabets to develop, because what you have in the proteins is a 20-letter alphabet. What you have in the RNA is a 4-letter alphabet. What you have in the DNA is a different 4-letter alphabet. And as he points out in the new book he's got coming out, it's those three alphabets that allow life to remain stable. You need those three alphabets working in such a way as to prevent errors from taking place. And he gives a potent argument in his next book about how there are literally billions and billions and billions of possible alphabet encoding structures. But what you see in life is the optimal coding structure for minimizing error propagation. And it says for that to happen by any naturalistic means is just an absurd claim. And then Fuzz is a membrane biochemist, and he talks about the membrane problem. He says it's one thing to get the DNA and the RNA and the proteins together. Now you've got to find some way to keep them from falling apart. Because in the natural realm, outside of a membrane, they fall apart very quickly. In some cases, just minutes. And so you have to find a membrane. And the real problem is this: you need to simultaneously evolve the appropriate membranes, multiple membranes, the RNA, the DNA, and the proteins, and you've got to have them all in the right locations. They used to think in Origin of Life research, it didn't matter where all these molecules were. We now know that the positions of the molecules are critical. They all have to be in the right location with respect to all the other molecules. And so this is really the reason why people are saying that there's no way this is going to happen without some kind of supernatural intervention. In fact, a fellow at that Origin of Life research conference known as Dr. No, and he's an atheist himself, Robert Shapiro, but that's his nickname, Dr. No, because every time somebody gives a lecture, he says, no, that won't work. But his comment is, you know, if we can't solve some of these problems here, we might as well invoke intelligent design. Because, and he says, you know, he was making the point, things are getting worse at each meeting, not better. Yes?
You know, another issue that I don't hear talked about much is, I would call it like manufacturing methods. I mean, for some of these compounds to come together, organic compounds require very cold temperatures, others require very hot temperatures, some require dry conditions, some require acidic conditions, and all of those things have to be happening at once for the DNA to form.
You're right. I mean, I wrote an article on this about 20 years ago, how if you're really serious about the origin of life from a naturalistic perspective, you need an environment in one location that's simultaneously very hot and very cold. And, of course, thermodynamically, that'll never happen. There's no way that you can have my thumb at a freezing temperature, this thumb at a freezing temperature, and this thumb at a boiling temperature. Thermodynamics is always going to make them roughly the same temperature. So that's a big issue. And of course, the pH is another issue. Some require basic conditions, some require acidic conditions, and the real problem is you've got to have both in the same locale, which is why you really have to do what Craig Venter is doing. You separately isolate these things in the lab and artificially bring them together by intelligent engineering mechanisms. Okay. Hey, the thing I really did want to talk to you about, and you know, this just got published literally 2 days ago. It's in the British journal Nature, and it has to do with Earth's core and actually ties in. Because what I'm going to be doing for the next few weeks is taking you through the three origins of life that Genesis 1 talks about. The three origins of life are the origin of life that's purely physical. We've been talking bacteria. Here's what some E. coli bacteria look like. And then we have the origin of what the Bible calls soulish life. And these are creatures endowed with mind, will, and emotion, so that they can nurture one another. It would include all animals that care for their young, which would be all the mammals, all the birds, and a handful of reptiles have limited care of their young. And also these are creatures that are endowed with a motivation to serve a higher being, namely us. They're designed to serve and please human beings, each in their own specific way. And this is kind of the topic of the next book I'm bringing out. It'll be out in a few months' time. And we see this as a powerful argument for a God, because these creatures were designed with these motivations to serve and please a higher being long before that higher being existed. So, you know, literally millions of years before human beings were even around, these creatures were designed with a motivation to serve and please human beings. And then the third origin of life is human beings, who, just like these creatures, are designed to serve and please a higher being. In their case, they're serving us. In our case, we're serving God. And so, and to put it in another way, this is purely physical life. This is life that's physical and soulish. This is life that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. Although I'm not arguing for a trichotomy of the human being, because what you see in the New Testament is the soulishness of the human being can never be separated from the spirit characteristics of the human being. So the Bible teaches a duality. We have a physical body, and then separate from that physical body is the soul and spirit of every human being. So when a physical body dies, the soul and spirit survive. And you say, what about these creatures? They all go to the dust of the earth. There's only one species that does not return to the earth and lives forever. That's the human species. So I'm going to kind of take you through these three origins of life, but I'm going to take you through these two origins fairly quickly, and we're really going to focus on human origins, because that's the topic of our text, Psalm 139. But in terms of the origin of life, this discovery that was just published in the last issue of Nature has some bearing. And what the discovery is all about, it's two geophysicists who have discovered some new structure in the core of the Earth. Now, this is kind of the standard textbook model of what the core of the Earth looks like. And this is something we only see in the Earth so far, at least, is that instead of just an inner core, we have a complex core in the sense that you have this inner core that's solid surrounded by a liquid core. And it's thanks to that liquid core that we have a strong magnetic field that protects our atmosphere from being sputtered away by the sun's radiation and also protects us from being killed by dangerous cosmic radiation. And then outside the liquid core, we have a mantle, which is kind of a soft material. And then this little thing here is the crust of the Earth. And so you get to see the different structures over here. The crust is actually a lot thinner than what you see there in that diagram. Now, one that actually does try to kind of put a little bit to scale is this particular one, where it shows the inner core going out a little more than 1,200 kilometers from the center of the Earth. And then you have the inner core, which is 2,270 kilometers from the inner core to the mantle boundary. So this is one of the bigger structures of the interior of the Earth. You know, that's important. A lot of people think that liquid core is small. It's not. It's one of the thickest layers. It's almost as thick as the mantle that sits above it. And then at the very top, we have a very thin crust. And the that's continental crust you see at the top. Number two there refers to the thickness of the crust that's at the bottom of the ocean. So at the bottom of the ocean, sometimes the crust is only about 4 miles thick. You could actually drill through that and get to the mantle. And there's actually been experiments proposed to go to some deep ocean water, drill down, and get right into the mantle because it is so thin compared to the continental crust. But what's brand new, just discovered, is that there is structure in this outer core of the Earth. And what they're finding is that as you go from C to B, I'm getting some pickup here, as you go from C to B, that was worse. Let me go back here. That the quantity of sulfur and oxygen, by the way, this inner core is almost entirely ferrous metals. It's iron, cobalt, nickel. So those are all magnetic metals, but the pressure there is so extreme that they're in solid form. Although there is some evidence that there may be a uranium core at the very center. We don't yet know whether there's... We do know there's a lot of uranium and thorium in the core of the Earth, but there actually might be a separate structure which would be pure uranium and thorium, and then beyond that, it would be iron, nickel, and cobalt. Now, what you see in the outer core of the Earth is also predominantly iron, nickel, and cobalt, but mixed within it are small amounts of sulfur and oxygen. But the new discovery is that as you go from C to B, the quantity of sulfur and oxygen increases. In fact, the outer 300 kilometers of the outer core, you see predominantly more sulfur and oxygen than you do in the inner part of the outer core. And you say, how did they discover this? Well, we've been blessed over the past 5 years with some really big earthquakes. And earthquakes are always exciting to geophysicists interested in the interior structure of the Earth. Why? Because when you get a big earthquake, it sends shock waves down into the interior of the Earth. And some of these shock waves will bounce off the mantle inner core boundary. Others will bounce off the inner core to outer core boundary. And what they're seeing is some bounce off in here that's different than what they get there. So that's how they made the discovery. And they kind of close their paper off saying, we can't wait for the next big earthquake so we can do more research.
These scientists are awfully weird.
They are awfully weird. But actually, what's responsible for this discovery is about 10 years ago, there were some major earthquakes and several nations decided to invest in putting on a network of seismographs. And so the United States has a very extensive network of seismographs. Japan has an extensive network. Indonesia has invested in putting in a network. They didn't have one before. They've got one now. Hawaii has a bunch. And so for the first time, we've had seismograph networks extensive enough that this research could actually be undertaken. But they close their paper off by saying, it'd be really great if we had like 50 of these networks instead of just 4. And so that's kind of what they're calling their paper, saying if we can actually establish networks like this in many more nations around the world, especially in places that are likely to get significant earthquakes, like Iran and China and Russia and India and Pakistan, South America, places down there, then we'd really be in business in terms of trying to get a detailed structure of the interior of the Earth, maybe even see whether or not we have this uranium core at the very center or not, and actually get some detail of what's going on in the inner core. But I'll tell you what's exciting. What's exciting is we have a fairly good understanding where this oxygen and sulfur came from. It came from what's called the late heavy bombardment. And this will pick up again. It plays a significant role in the origin of life, in the sense that the origin of life takes place immediately after the late heavy bombardment, which is one of the proofs we have that the origin of life occurred in a geologic instant of time rather than a long period of time, like Carl Sagan would argue. But it's this late heavy bombardment that infused the interior of the Earth with oxygen and sulfur. Basically what happened, I'll just kind of give you an idea of what was taking place here. In the early history of the solar system, you have this gigantic belt of asteroids and comets. Today we call it the Kuiper Belt. And it's a belt of comets and asteroids that exist just beyond the orbit of Neptune. So between 4 and 6.5 billion miles away from the Sun, you've got this belt of asteroids and comets. What we know from the dynamics of the solar system, as well as the Kuiper Belt objects, there was a time when that Kuiper Belt was located much closer to the Sun, basically where Saturn is orbiting right now. And moreover, we now know that it was 100 times bigger than what it is now. And in the early history of the solar system, when you have a giant belt of asteroids and comets orbiting the Sun at the same distance that a big planet orbits the Sun, you get a dynamic interaction between the planet and the asteroids and the comets. And what it does is it causes the planet to move outward. And so Saturn is farther away from the Sun than it was before this interaction really got going. And that would also affect the orbits of Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune. All of them were moving outward. But because this belt was closest to Saturn, Saturn moved faster than the other planets. Yes?
What's the mass of the Kuiper Belt compared to, say, Jupiter or all the planets combined with the Sun?
Well, I used to know this number, but what astronomers do is they compare it to the mass of the Earth. So the total sum is not anywhere near as big as Jupiter or Saturn, but I'm trying to remember how many times bigger than the Earth it is.
Oh, okay. Well,
so it's not very massive, but the fact that there is distributed over such a broad range, literally millions of objects, the effect of that is kind of act as a dust or some kind of a drag, if you like, that causes the planets to move outward.
It's more comparable to the solar mass or Jupiter mass.
It's closer to Earth's mass than it is to Jupiter's mass. I can tell you that much, and if you go on the web, you can find the exact figure. Today, it's much less. But it was, I think, several times the mass of the Earth before this event took place. Okay, back to the picture. So you got Saturn moving out faster than you got Jupiter. And Jupiter and Saturn together account for more than 90% of the total mass of all the bodies in the solar system. And so you can dynamically pay most attention to Jupiter and Saturn. But what happened is it reached a point where Saturn was making exactly one orbit around the Sun for every two orbits of Jupiter. And that's called a 1-2 resonance. And what's happening there as Jupiter begins to orbit the Sun, every second orbit, it perfectly lines up with Saturn. And so here you got these two planets that make up more than 90% of the mass of all the planets in our solar system having this perfect lineup, literally every couple of decades. And what that does is it destabilizes the Kuiper Belt of asteroids and comets. scattered them into the into outer space. Some, the rest of them, were scattered into the inner solar system. And so there is a scattering event that peaked at about 3.85 billion years ago. And the effect that it had on the Earth was to generate 17,000 plus extremely destructive collision events. You say, what do you mean? I'm talking asteroids and comets that are bigger than 10 miles in diameter. And those are kind of continent-destroying collision events. And so in a relatively brief period of time, the planet was being pummeled by these objects. And by the way, if you want to get a feel for what that did, you can look at the moon. The moon took only 3% the damage that the Earth took. But as you look at the moon, about 95% of the craters you see in the moon were formed at this event. Say, how do we know that? The moon has a very small atmosphere of argon, and we can measure the rotation rate of the moon, calculate its past rotation rates, and therefore determine how much those craters should be eroded. And the erosion that we measure adds up to about 3.85 billion years ago. And there's another way we can get at that. We can calculate the timing it would take for this lineup, this 1-2 resonance to be developed. You also get a date of 3.85 billion years. So as we look at the weathering of the craters on the moon, we get the same date as we do for the dynamical calculation of this 1-2 resonance of Jupiter and Saturn, which tells us that 99% of the Kuiper belt was destroyed, and then the Kuiper belt moved outward beyond the planets as a direct result of that. But this heavy bombardment took the sulfur and the oxygen that were on the surface of the Earth and infused it into the core of the Earth. And so that was one of the bigger geophysical effects of this event, is that it took all the sulfur and oxygen, the crust of the Earth, not all of it, but a good amount of it, and pushed it into the core of the Earth. Now, that's really good because sulfur is deadly for life. Sulfur is one of these vital elements. You need it to live. And you know, some of us here have at various times in our life been sulfur deficient. And so you can take pills or eat certain vegetables that are rich in sulfur, and that'll take care of it. But too much sulfur will also kill you. And what we see about our planet is we're about 60 times deficient in sulfur compared to Mars. Mars has got 60 times the sulfur we have. And Mars also took a lot of damage. You see the craters on Mars? They too were formed during the late heavy bombardment. But they took much less damage than the Earth did. And so that explains in part why Mars has so much sulfur than we have. But having so little sulfur has been crucial for making advanced life possible. And so the sulfur that would normally be here got driven into the core interior. But let me take you back to the previous slide here. What these researchers are suggesting, until they get more earthquake data, is that what was really taking place in the late heavy bombardment is that the sulfur and the oxygen that were in the crust of the Earth got driven down into the base of the inner outer part of the outer core. And so this would have been where all the oxygen and sulfur were. And over the past several billion years, this oxygen and sulfur has been floating up to the outer part of the liquid core. And so today, 3.85 billion years later, most of the oxygen and sulfur now exists here rather than here. But what they're suggesting is that this flow of sulfur and oxygen up into the upper part of the inner core is responsible for driving the motion of the liquid iron, cobalt, and nickel, and this is what's setting up our powerful magnetic field. And if it wasn't for this flow of oxygen and sulfur, our magnetic field wouldn't have been sustained at the powerful level that it is literally for the past 3.8 billion years. And thanks to the sulfur and oxygen that's been bubbling up, they suggest, is why we're able to have advanced life on our planet. So bottom line is, this is a fine-tuning argument, is that you know you need enormous fine-tuning to make sure it doesn't bubble up too fast or bubble up too slowly, and it actually drives the kind of motions that are necessary to keep our magnetic field at about one gauss. And this is a problem geophysicists have been wrestling with literally for 50 years. Our planet Earth should not have such a strong, stable magnetic field, but it does. And the big enigma is why? Why is such a tiny planet blessed with this very powerful and long-lasting magnetic field? And this is now suggesting the reason why. Now, to really nail this down, we need more big earthquakes with lots of networks of seismographs to pick up the data so we can actually make this model much more detailed than it is right now. So I guess they're praying for earthquakes. So, yeah, go ahead. You may be referring to some articles about the planet Venus having episodes of volcanic activity, because it seems like it remains stagnant for hundreds of millions of years, some say even a billion years. Then it has a brief episode of volcanic activity, then it goes back into this long, stable period. There's research being done on that. It's all highly speculative at this point, but we do see on Venus what looks like extensive lava flows that were brought about through episodic events separated by hundreds of millions, if not maybe a billion years. So they're trying to explain how that happened. Nobody really has any good insight on that. We don't have seismographs on the surface of Venus to do this kind of research. But we do see those lava flows, and they're it's not like Mars, where you get small lava flows happening on a fairly regular basis. And Venus seems to be long periods where nothing happens, then you get a flow, then long periods that nothing happens. And one reason we can see that on Venus is it has very little erosion. And so because of the lack of erosion, old lava flows are still there to be investigated. Whereas here on the Earth, all that stuff's been eroded away. In the back, you've had your hand up a long time. Yeah, sulfur is a vital poison. Okay, yeah. I mean, is there a worry that sulfur is going to make it up to the surface and make the surface of the planet unlivable for advanced life? Nothing to worry about in the immediate future. I mean, 4 billion years down the road, yeah, you may have some concerns when the sun gets really hot and big. But right now, the mantle acts as a barrier. So, as you go out, the viscosity goes up. And so that viscosity, in fact, a lot of the paper talks about the viscous nature of the outer core of the Earth and how that plays a role in slowing down the movement of the oxygen sulfur. And that's important because if the viscosity is low, then this stuff bubbles up pretty quickly. And that would be a problem. You want it to move very slowly so as to keep the field at a nice strong level for literally billions of years. And see, that's one of the unique factors of the Earth. We have a small planet with a strong magnetic field that remains stable for billions of years. And that's something we see in no other body in the universe. It appears to be unique to the Earth. And now we're trying to understand how it is that the Earth had this unique set of features that makes advanced life possible. So another way to put it, this is part of what's called the rare Earth doctrine. You know, when astronomers look at all these planets and develop their models of planet formation, they're discovering that only Earth has the features that make advanced life possible. Yes?
You were mentioning the three origins of life. Mm-hmm. You talked about the mammals before we came along. What was the word you used, subservient? Or
How they're designed and motivated to serve and please human beings.
Serve and please human beings. Is that, and then we were sort of created to serve and please God.
Correct.
So now the mammals to serve and please us. Are you talking about fur, clothing, meat,
eat them,
food. I mean, is that what?
That's part of it.
Does that mean that God's going to start eating us?
Okay. We serve and please God in a different way than the birds and mammals and higher reptiles serve and please us. But you're right. When it comes to these soulless creatures, they provide service for us in supporting our agricultural industry.
Excuse me. So when you say soulless, what does soulless mean?
Soul-ish. Okay, it's based on the Old Testament Hebrew word nephesh. You see it in Genesis chapter 1 on creation day 5, where it says God creates a nephesh. And it means a life form that's not only physical, but also soulish. And the demarcation that you see in other places in the Bible is that the life forms that are purely physical, they basically only care about themselves. They pay no attention whatsoever to their young. So, for example, when a fish lays eggs, it swims away from the eggs and never sees the eggs again. It does nothing to provide support for the eggs other than just providing the eggs. However, when a crocodile gives birth to eggs, the mother will take some initiative at her personal expense, to protect the newborn crocodiles from being eaten by predators. However, when you look at reptiles, the way they nurture their young is orders of magnitude below what you see in birds and mammals. You know, like a mother and a father bird will literally spend months of nurturing with their newborn chicks. Reptiles will not do that. You know, it's a much more limited degree of nurture. And then with the higher mammals, it's even greater again, where they literally take years to protect and nurture their young. And with us human beings these days, it's what, 30, 35 years we spend nurturing our young before they're ready to support themselves? So.
Soulless, then, does that come from the word soul? Or I'm still not.
Well, the confusing part is this. The Greek word for soul has a different definition than the Hebrew word for soul. And so people get confused looking at how the Old Testament treats soul and the New Testament treats soul. In the New Testament, soul is used almost exclusively for human beings. There's only one place in the New Testament where it uses the Greek word for soul for animals. And again, just for the mammals. But in the Old Testament, it's frequently used for birds and mammals and sometimes the higher reptiles. The demarcation is this. It's an animal that nurtures its young, cares for its young, prepares its young to survive in the real world, and is also a creature that is able to form an emotional relationship with a human being and serve and please a human being in some specific way. And it tells us in the book of Job, every bird and mammal species is designed in a different way to serve and please human beings, which is the tragedy of human beings driving to extinction 4,000 species of mammals and 11,000 species of birds. These were creatures that were designed to serve and please us in ways that are different from the ones that exist today. And so we've lost out on a whole lot of support from these creatures that we drove to extinction.
If man is doing this to destroy that nature, how come God hasn't stepped in to say, don't do that?
Well, if you go to the book of Job, you'll see Job telling his three friends, you want to learn about God? Look to the soulish animals. It says, the birds will instruct you. The mammals will teach you. They'll teach you deep spiritual lessons you need to learn. And I'm writing about this in my next book. And, you know, one obvious lesson is this. It's our sin that causes us to limit the degree to which these birds and mammals can serve and please us. I mean, they were highly motivated to serve and please us. Because of our sin, they run away from us. And so we've lost out on what they can provide for us. But in the same manner that our sin damages our relationships with birds and mammals, our sin also damages our capacity to serve and please God. And so by looking to these soulish animals, we can see the problem we have with God. It's our sin that gets in the way of us really being able to have a fulfilling relationship with our Creator. Our relationship with Him can be far more rewarding if it wasn't for the sin that operates within each of us.
So we're kind of screwed both ways.
Well, here's a positive way of looking at it. Just as God endowed birds and mammals to be highly motivated to form a relationship with a higher being, He's done the same thing with us. He's designed us to be powerfully motivated to relate to a higher being. And so again, if you want to learn about God, look at these birds and mammals. And one thing I write about in my next book is this, is that people who deny the existence of God are typically people who don't have much contact with a wide panoply of bird and mammal species. I mean, I've yet to find an atheist that lives on a farm where that farmer is relating to a wide number of species of birds and mammals. The atheists tend to live in cities where the only birds and mammals they see are, highly bred dogs and cats. It's not quite the same as seeing the animals in their natural state. Like when you talk to farmers, they will be telling you about the amazing way these animals are motivated to increase our economic well-being. One of the things I write about in my next book is the cow. How the cow is highly motivated to do heavy labor for its human owner. It won't do it for other cows, it'll only do it for us.
Yeah, you know? Like, what happens is that we're heading for 7 billion, 8 billion, 10 billion in the future, population. And we're already driving hundreds of thousands of animals and life into extinction. So what's going to happen as human population grows like it's growing now?
Well, you're raising a good point, Al, is that human beings are driving to extinction bird and mammal species at the highest rate they ever have in human history, except for the initial human invasion of North and South America and Australia. I mean, that was much more devastating than what we're experiencing today. But it's still at an alarmingly high rate. And yeah, if the human population continues to expand, it could get worse. However, there are demographers that are talking about a much more alarming crisis, which is a future collapse of the human population and what that's going to do for those of us that are heading towards retirement age, where there won't be enough workers to pay our pension funds. So, what they've been noticing is that those nations that have low birth rates, the drop in the birth rate is accelerating. There used to be the idea that birth rates will drop to a certain level and then stabilize. We're not seeing that. Nations that have falling birth rates, the birth rate is actually accelerating as time goes by. Probably the worst example of that in the world is Singapore, where the birth rate is now just 0.55 children per adult. But what was alarming was it was only a few years ago where it was 0.8 per adult. So literally, in just the past couple of decades, it went from 0.8 down to 0.55, and it's actually accelerating. And basically, they're saying it's heading to zero.
Why? Why do you think that's?
Well, it happens most rapidly in highly urbanized cultures. Japan, Italy, and Singapore are probably the most dramatic examples of rapidly falling birth rates. So when they're urbanized, it seems to accelerate the drop in birth. And I think the idea there is, if you're living in a city, it's not to your economic advantage to have lots of children. If you're living on a farm, having children is to your economic advantage because every child you have is one more person you can put to work on the farm. And so, for example, in early America, the average number of children per woman was above 10. And that's because back in the 18th century, the more children you had, the wealthier you became. And so people were highly motivated to have children. It means they could increase their income level. But if you're living in cities, it's the other way around. The more children you have, the poorer you are. And so people are motivated. And, of course, today we have birth control, so we could actually limit the number of children we have. But the thing they're seeing, especially in Japan and Singapore, is young single women really enjoying their singleness, where they're making a lot of money and spending their money on travel, high-tech gadgets, and a lot of fun. It's like, you know, if we get married, all that's going to end. And so they're, quote, enjoying the good life without a husband and without children. But what that does is it really drops the birth rate down to a very low level. And some are arguing that unless there's a serious economic collapse, we could be looking at just 1 billion people by the year 2100. It could drop that fast. Well, one way to stop it is for us to go back to a poverty-level income. But there's not a lot of motivation in the population to have our standard of living drop by, say, a factor of 10. So, but this is a looming crisis we're facing. And it's actually worse than that in the sense that with women putting off having children and men putting off having children, that dramatically increases the deleterious mutation rate, which means that you get rapid genetic decay. And some have argued that that genetic decay could prove the end of the human species literally less than 2,000 years from now. So we could be extinct in just that period of time. And blame it all on technology and affluence. So, yes. Well, we need to end. We're 5 minutes over. Yeah, but you, and then two quick questions, then we're going to close.
So the mammals serve humans, humans serve God. And I guess God doesn't serve anybody else. It stops at God.
Yeah, there's always the place where the buck stops.
So the buck stops at God.
Well, the angels serve him too. I mean, God designed everything to serve that which is perfect. I mean, I was arguing with an atheist last night and said, you know, why does God demand worship? And I says, because as spiritual beings, we are programmed to worship. Every human being worships something. You either worship these little white balls and green patches of grass, or you worship a higher being. We all worship something. And God knows that if we worship anything else except him, we're worshiping that which is not perfect. And we worship something that's not perfect, it has devastating consequences on our well-being. Both
that's false idols. Is that what you're talking about?
Pardon me?
False idols,
yeah. They will disappoint you. So the message of the Bible is worship God and only God, because he's the only thing you can worship that will not disappoint you. Everything else you worship will disappoint you. Your wife, your kids, your bank account. Your
$50 billion could disappoint you?
It certainly can.
Really?
Well, I mean, there are people who've lost that kind of...
Go ahead.
You can suffer with that until the real thing comes along.
Yeah. Then the government wants to tax you and take it all away, right? And that'll be very disappointing. Okay. There's a question in the back. Go ahead.
Yeah, about... You said that in urban settings, there's more atheism, there's less religion. On your thing about the birth rates, could you compare that with the religious versus the non-religious, and holding constant the rest of the things about their urbanization and about their wealth and their technology?
Well, that, I think, is a myth that's being exploded, because there are people saying, you know, look at all the children that Mormons are having and Muslims are having. Is there a correlation between religion and birth rate? Do Christians, for example, have more children than non-Christians do? And what they've discovered is, religion is not that much of a factor. What's the real factor is the level of wealth and technology that the individual enjoys. And what we're really discovering, for example, is say that Muslims on a worldwide level enjoy a lower level of technology and wealth than Christians do. So that would in itself explain the difference in the birth rate. And what they've noticed with Muslims, as they gain wealth and technology, their birth rate likewise drops. So that seems to be the predominant correlation, wealth and technology, not what you believe. And where you live. In fact, what's interesting, if they look at cities, especially in the third world, where you live in the city has an impact on your birth rate. So people in the suburbs have a higher birth rate than people who live in the downtown area. So, but again, you can understand that people living in the downtown area are more likely to be influenced by technology. And by the way, how many hours people work is a factor. The more hours they work, the less children they have. The more electricity they consume, the less children they have.
The more blackouts, the more people have.
That's true. They've observed that even in high-tech countries, that when they have a blackout, the birth rate drops or goes up. So, see, that would be one solution, just have lots of blackouts. So, okay, we're going to close. Father in heaven, we thank you for this very initial introduction into our discussion on what your word says, and especially Psalm 139 about the three origins of life. And Lord, I pray that would give us some insights into how you want us to relate to the three different levels of life on this planet. Most importantly, how you want us to relate to you. So Lord, I pray that you would give us understanding and insight and knowledge as we study both the book of nature and the book of scripture on this important topic. Give us all a blessed Christmas, Lord, and I pray this Christmas we would have many opportunities to share the good news of what you did 2,000 years ago in coming to our planet. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
I had a question, but you didn't get to me. Where did the oxygen come from?